Meeting is now being recorded.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the RPM Subteam for URS Documents call on Wednesday, the 18th of July, 2018. Attendance for today's meeting will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you're only on the audio bridge, would you please let yourself be known now? And I'd like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for the recording purposes, and please keep phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. And with this, I will turn it over to Brian Beckham.
All right, thank you. Welcome, everyone. I think we had a good call last week where we went through and kind of agreed that we thought we had accomplished most of the tasks that we were out to do in this working group. So first, maybe I can start by asking if anyone has any updates to their statements of interest. Barring that, if there were any comments on the agenda that Barry sent around earlier, and if there are no comments or updates, then we can kick off. Okay, so hearing none. I don't know if people had a chance to look, and I apologize. It took me a little longer than I imagined it would to add my comments, which to a large degree overlap the comments that Barry entered in the document, the chart here. But I think where we are on this call was to go through one last time to see that we all agree that we have done the initial task that this sub-team set out to do, which was to identify the sources of information. That's this document sub-team. So we were meant to identify documents that would help inform our policy views on the URS. So I thought we could go through the chart to see, do we agree that we have actually covered off that task that we were initially set out to do. If not, if there are other areas where we feel that we can still identify data that would be useful, then let's go ahead and do that. And then I think the idea was to go through this call and start to see whether we can't draw any preliminary conclusions. To be honest, I think on this call and for this sub-team, my kind of rough assessment of going through the document earlier today was that there weren't a tremendous amount of observations and potential recommendations. There were a few, of course, but that what we would actually do was we would produce our own limited set of recommendations in this sub-team, and each of the other sub-teams are also doing that same task. So if just sort of roughly speaking, each of the sub-teams is going to contribute a quarter of the recommendations, then the next task would be for the co-chairs and possibly a new sub-team to start to bring those recommendations from each of the sub-teams together for discussion within the full working group. So does that sound like a good plan? Does everyone agree that that's sort of where we are? Any suggestions for a better way forward? Anything that we may be missing? Okay, so I see on the screen that we have the document. I think this is the one that I sent through, which has my comments and the comments of Barry and staff in terms of identifying the document sources. So if everyone is agreeable, why don't we I see Barry has his hand up. Go ahead, Barry.
Thank you, Brian. I just wanted to note one thing that as a suggestion that in terms of any deliberations we have here, that we definitely be careful about our wording. As we review through each of these issues, each of these sections, and determine, you know, if an issue warrants further investigation, or instead of actually calling them recommendations, maybe just call them preliminary conclusions at this point, noting that the fact that, you know, the full working group hasn't seen much of the sub-team's data, at least as it relates to this sub-team. We want to be careful not to set off alarms for the larger working group that that there's any concrete decisions being made out of this sub-team. In terms of next steps, what I was going to suggest in terms of when we start down the complaint, because we are dealing with four documents that will be floating through, I'm going to instead just share my screen as we walk through the document you see before you here, and then as we move over into either the provider's table or the practitioner's table or the compilation document, I think it'll be easier for you to follow along as I switch through those documents. And then on the side, Mary will be taking notes of any issues that the team wants to push forward for deliberations in the larger working group and or some of the preliminary conclusions that we discuss here, if that's acceptable.
Yeah, absolutely, and thanks, Barry, for the reminder. I see there's a comment from David. Did anyone else lose audio? I'm on the phone, so I'm able to hear Barry, and I see Mary saying that the Adobe Connect seems to be working, so and I see David typing, so maybe we'll see if he can get on the phone or can connect through the Adobe. And just to completely affirm what you've said, Barry, that maybe I was slightly inarticulate, but for me, it's absolutely gone without saying that whatever we discuss and put forward, I'm using the term recommendations, in this sub-team would go to the full working group for consideration. So you're absolutely right that maybe a better formulation will be preliminary recommendations or issues for consideration. But absolutely, it's paramount that we whatever we look at goes to the full working group for consideration. And I see we've just lost the, at least I've lost the document on the screen for the time being. I hope if people don't see the document on the screen, that at least they have the document maybe in front of them, if not printed off in an electronic format. So if we start at the beginning, if you recall, there were a number of questions in the initial phases where these were sort of taken wholesale and put into the charter. And at some point along the way, the working group thought it would be useful to sort of refine these questions. And that sort of evolved further into a series of five overarching questions from Heather, the GNSO chair, to sort of help hone our work. And so we sort of parked the idea of refining those questions whilst the different sub-teams were doing their data gathering and recommendation forming exercises, and so I think we're in the phase of bringing those preliminary recommendations from the sub teams together, and then we can collectively see what we do with that earlier work in terms of refining those questions that were in the charter or refining the chart. But in any event, the way I've looked at it is that refining whether it's the questions that were in the original charter or the questions that were in this chart wasn't necessarily meant to be the tail that wags the dog. These were really to help frame our discussions with the view of making policy recommendations. So while we can certainly come back to these questions, at least for present purposes, I don't see a real strong need to roll up our sleeves too much and wordsmith those. It was, again, just to sort of frame our data gathering tasks and to help us, pull together some recommendations for the working group and then the broader community to consider. So I see we're back on the screen and we're in the section, the beginning of the chart where we're dealing with the complaint. So these were some issues about for example, standing to file, grounds, the administrative review, et cetera. And we had identified a couple of different sources for data. So we had the provider responses. We had Rebecca Tushnet's very good research. And we had the practitioner survey. And so I think we've concluded our initial task of identifying the sources of the data. And so then the question for us is, now that we have the data, are there any recommendations we as a sub-team want to start to pull out of that, or do we sort of collectively decide that, in fact, it's more, let's say, for example, the provider sub-team where they're looking at issues with the complaint, maybe it's a notification issue, communications with registries, registrars, filing parties. So I guess the question that probably, you know, hangs over each of these sections, and so we can start with this section here is, A, do folks agree that we've completed the task of identifying all of the sources of data? And then B, do we have any recommendations ourselves from what we've seen when we've identified sources of data? And then, of course, that went a little bit further when we started to look at some of the appealed cases and some of the statistics around the URS. And sort of a sub-B was, if we have any recommendations ourselves, or even if we don't have any recommendations ourselves, do we want to say, for example, since we flagged in this particular column the provider's responses from the survey, do we want to just sort of make a note in the margins for ourselves that what we want to do, whether it's a further iteration of this sub-team or a new sub-team, to say that sub-team ought to look at the responses from the providers, the responses from the practitioner surveys, et cetera. So in other words, just to sort of catalog, you know, when we're looking at, again, in this particular example, the complaint, which of the sub-teams might have information that's useful to pull into preliminary recommendations. So for the first question, I think it's safe to say that we've adequately identified all of the sources of data. If people feel otherwise, obviously, feel free to speak up. And so then that takes us to the next question of, do we have any things that we've identified when we've started to look at these sources of data when it comes to the issues around the complaint? Or do we want to flag that there's data that's coming from other sub-teams? And this, again, goes to the effort of coordinating the recommendations and the observations from those other sub-teams for either this sub-team or another sub-team to look at. So maybe just, again, to recap, do people agree that we've completed the task of identifying sources of data for the complaint-related issues? And so I'll go. I see John McElwain put yes in the chat, and I think maybe this is broadly speaking, the effort that we're going to be going through today is in the area of proving a negative, if you will, in the EERP terms that I'm familiar with. So unless we hear otherwise from people, I think we can presume so. So I see John and David agreeing that we've identified the sources of data. So then taking to the next part of this, whether it's the provider surveys or Rebecca's research, does anyone on the call here have any observations that you think would be useful for us to record to send up to the broader working group or to kind of just chronicle here for the further work of this or a new iteration of this sub-team? So I see David has put a comment in the chat. When it comes to comment, he will have a few on appeals. I'm just going to quickly turn my pages to see which letter that is. That's G, so we'll come to that shortly. So for A, just again to recap, did anyone have any observations from what we've seen? We had the presentation in Panama, and hopefully we've started to look ourselves as a sub-team at some of the surveys. Did anyone have any observations that you think it would be useful to record when it comes to the complaint? I see Barry's put a comment. He can't raise his hand but would like to expand, so go ahead. And then I see John has his hand raised. So, John, after Barry, then please go ahead.
All right, thank you, Brian. Barry Cobb for the record. So, you know, I was kind of hopeful that we would methodically go through this as more specifically just walking through column 4. So, you know, for example, you know, this subteam had only asked the providers, you know, give us any information about the administrative review and stats. And so that has been fulfilled. And so to kind of go through that, it refers to page 11, rows 30 and 31, and more specifically, let me get down to that. Specifically, the providers were asked, you know, had there been any issues with regards to meeting the 2 business day requirement of conducting the administrative review? And then secondarily, how many complaints have been found non-compliant? Forum still hadn't responded to the particular question on row 30. However, in terms of the ask from this subteam, was looking for administrative review stats. So ADN, DRC, they had more than 2 cases. I think what was interesting here is that they chose in those cases where it did fail the administrative review that they're still classified as withdrawn and presented on their provider site. Whereas Forum and MFSD also had corresponding cases, 17 and 3 respectively, based on my understanding is that those particular cases that failed administrative review aren't necessarily presented on the provider site. So kind of just taking that in context for this particular ask, are there any issues that this group sees around these particular responses as it relates to administrative review, or, you know, is there anything else that we should look into or any preliminary conclusions based on this particular, based on these particular responses? And I'll turn it back to you, Brian.
Okay, thanks, Barry. I think that's, yeah, that's really, that's a bit of a chicken and egg question for us in this subteam. I think that that could be a very useful way forward. I want us maybe just collectively to kind of understand and agree that, that while we can go through those, just to be mindful that, that there may be complementary recommendations from the other subteams. And John, I know that you had your hand up.
Thanks. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Sorry about that. My actual question was, and it, maybe it's kind of getting to what Barry was getting at, is dropping down to like the point right above B, the notice where it says Rebecca's research should show what types of marks are the subject of complaints. And I just didn't know what that meant. I think I maybe even asked this question on last call. So I don't know if that helps, but I think at that level of detail is probably what it takes, a little bit of background behind some of these points, because, for instance, I don't know what types of marks means with respect to Rebecca's research. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, John. And this is Brian again for the record. I think you did, and I even maybe caught that in the last call, and I think we had a discussion with Kathy and Rebecca. And if my memory serves, and please someone feel free to correct me, but what we had agreed was that that question was actually more geared towards the TMCH and the claims notices. I think there were some questions about the types of marks and what type of information was presented to potential registrants. So I think that one was not really so much for this subteam, but that was more for the TMCH and claims notices types question. Does anyone else have a similar or different recommendation?
This is Barry, and I just note that I actually recollect more of the history around that. And I don't think that it's so much tied to the TMCH as much as it is for the standing to file and a better understanding of, you know, what types of marks are allowed that would give that appropriate standing to file. I think that was kind of the nexus of where that comment came from. Whether it's in scope or not is yet to be discussed, but I don't think it had a lot less to do with the TMCHS.
Yes, thanks, Barry. And this is Brian again for the record. And I see Mary's put a comment in the chat room. And I think, Mary, you're exactly right that there may be a more fundamental question about whether the types of marks, descriptive, fanciful, that sort of thing should be grounds for standing under the URS. Unless people really feel strongly about having a discussion on this, I personally believe that this is really a can of worms that we're not going to get anywhere with in this subteam, and possibly in the working group generally. We've had a lot of interesting discussions, I recall, about, you know, the strength of marks and dictionary terms, you know, serving as a mark in one context and as a dictionary term in another context. But again, not to say it's not an interesting topic, but I really, frankly fail to see that within, this subteam or the working group generally, the type of mark, that would provide standing to get in the door for a URS complaint, will go anywhere. This really gets to the kind of the core nature of trademarks. And you know, this is an area that's well settled, legally around the world for, you know, over 100 years now. And I think that again, it's a very interesting topic, but we're not going to solve the problem in this subteam or this working group. And so I see David agreeing, and Mary's comment. Does the data on types of marks reveal any problems or need to amend, clarify the standing requirement? You know, Mary, it's an interesting question. And maybe what we can do, just so we can keep moving today, is we can note that as a question that's been raised, and then just see how people in the broader working group want to tackle that question, if they're minded to tackle that. So, if that works for everyone, we can note that it's a question that's been raised. We're not going to attempt to solve it here, and then we'll see what the broader working group wants to do with that. So, do people, just back to the question that Barry raised a little earlier about going through kind of point by point on the information in column 4, is that agreeable to everyone to start to go through that and see if we want to start pulling some preliminary notions together for this subteam? If that works, I don't know if Barry or whoever is controlling the document can flick us back to the provider questions on page 11, and we can see if there aren't anything that we can draw from those responses in terms of potential recommendations. So I'm just trying to multitask, read the answers. I apologize. I didn't realize we were going to go to this level of inquiry. So I don't have my documents with my notes in front of me, so I'll have to sort of try to quickly jog my memory with what's on our screen. From memory, though, in terms of the complaint, the standing to file, the grounds for filing, and the administrative review, does anyone have any thoughts on the data that we see here on our screen or from memory or from the presentation from the provider subteam that we should record here for ourselves and the working group to think about? So I see, for example, there are some cases where the case was dismissed for non-payment or it was meant for a domain name like .com for which the URS doesn't apply. I think those are questions that are frankly a complainant not paying attention, and there's no real policy recommendation to be made out of that. Of course, there may be broader questions about applying the URS across existing TLDs, but again, that's a bigger policy question for the working group to think about. And as far as the UR stands today, that's simply an issue of a complainant not really understanding the limitation of the URF to new GTLDs. So I see there are some questions where the providers have experienced some issues with locking of a domain name within the time frame that's allowed within the URS, and that could be due to the GDPR has been raised. There could be communications issues with the registrars and the registries. I know there was a suggestion made earlier that the information that's provided by ICANN, I think there's a monthly report of contact information that's provided, and there was a question about making sure that that's up to date and authoritative. So possibly that could be one recommendation to make sure that actually is happening, that the registries and registrars, if they're updating their contact information, that is passed over to ICANN in a timely manner, then that ICANN is able to pass that over to providers in a timely manner. Certainly that seems like an easy fix and something that we could recommend. And I see that Barry has his hand raised again.
Thank you, Brian. So, again, the reason why I'm trying to shepherd us through this specific column 4 is it has pointers to all of these data sources. So when we were just talking about the administrative review, it was specific only rows 30 and 31. It didn't sound like there was any feedback or any other issue identification as it relates to the administrative review. But then secondarily, then we have our second source from the practitioners that we had asked for qualitative experiences about what they were seeing in regards to standing grounds and filing. And so before, you know, moving on to the notice of complaint and locking of domain, we'll get down to that in another section. Only rows 30 and 31 right here were the scope of conversation around administrative review. And now let's move down to look at the practitioner's survey, which was that qualitative response. And so looking at that, on pages 21 and 22, as well as 28 and 29, there were 4 survey questions that get around into standing, evidence, and grounds, as well as a couple additional ones from the providers. I'm sorry, the practitioners. So if we were to look at the practitioner surveys, pages 21 and 22, there were 2 survey questions. Sorry for the scroll. The first, practical issues, as they labeled the section. Do you believe that submission of a declaration and a specimen of current use in commerce should be adequate evidence of use for a URS case? Again, there were a total of 14 responses within the survey. Most, if not all, close to all, had responded that they either agreed or strongly agreed to that particular question. The secondary survey question follows on, and do you believe that the submission of an SMD file from the TMCH will demonstrate that evidence of use was filed with the TMCH, and should that be adequate proof for use for a URS case? Here, 10 responses out of 14 had answered yes. And then secondarily, pages 28 and 29 of the survey, and again, sorry for the scrolling here. Do you believe the existing limitations on the submission of evidence in a URS proceeding are appropriate? 7 agree, 1 strongly agrees. Neither, there was 1 response of neither agree nor disagree. And then secondarily is provide any comments back to that. And then there were a few that said Often exhibits are required to prove a point that can't be captured in 500 words. Regarding submission of evidence, allowance should be made for evidence of cyber swatting beyond what may be shown in resolving websites. Example given, evidence of other bad faith activities such as phishing, that should be more easily accommodated in the ORS process. And then lastly, they need a clear way to submit that additional evidence. So those are four other questions to consider in this larger topic of the complaint. And I'll stop there, but, you know, then we have a few more sources to look at below here.
Yeah, thanks, Barry. And this is Brian again. And I just wanted to, and thank you for pointing us to those. I noticed that there was in the practitioner survey, there was pretty wide agreement that the SMB file, for example, should be sufficient. I recall, however, some other discussions that there were some concerns about the SMB file and how respondents were able to read those. So certainly it's, you know, it's interesting and useful to see that for some of the practitioners who have responded to this survey, they felt it was adequate. But I think it's important that we record that other practitioners or respondents had raised some issues with what they're able to see or more accurately not see in the SMD file. So I think, you know, we want to be careful that we don't misstate wide agreement across the board with the SMD file being adequate. Certainly, if some people who responded to the survey felt that was the case, we'll note that. But I think, again, just to note that there were some concerns raised elsewhere about whether that was adequate on the recipient's part. And I see John McElwain has his hand raised.
Thanks, Brian. John McElwain for the record. Maybe we can also get to the bottom of the SMD file issue here. And I don't know if anybody on this call can help, or we can just task somebody to figure this out. And I've got one open right now. Are they, if you have some sort of decoding software, if you open it up, can you get information about the trademark from it? I mean, right now, when I get them, it is just a string of letters, which I thought was all an SMD file ever was a essentially a code that verified that a mark was registered. We've heard all this stuff like, oh, I can't open an SMD file or I can't read it. Can somebody find out the answers to whether you are actually supposed to be able to open it? Well, I know you can open it, but whether you can actually read it as a normal practitioner and not as a trademark clearinghouse. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, John. And I see Barry's put a comment in the chat that I think you'd need a key from the TMCH to decode that. So maybe that's a question that we note has been raised, that that there have been some issues with reading these SMD files, and maybe we query whether that's something that could be solved through coordination with the Trademark Clearinghouse, or whether it would require something else, because I think we could all agree that it's important that people are able to know information about the trademark that's been used to file a case if they're on the receiving end of a case or even the deciding end of a case. So if people agree, that can be something that we note that there may be an issue around, as Mary's put in the chat, the non-human readable parts of the SMD file, to make sure that that people are understanding the information about the trademark on which the URS claim is based.
Yeah, just I'm sorry, this is John McElwain, just to answer Mary's question. So if you look at a SMD file, open it with Notepad, it's going to say marks, and then it's going to say what the mark is, and then it's going to have a number code, and then it's going to have some information, some labels, and then it's going to have some dates, and then it's going to say begin encoded SMD, and it's going to be a long string of letters and numbers. And so I think what we need to solve for is what information can be obtained from this file if you had a decoder ring. Thank you.
Thanks, John. And I think it seems I see Zach has agreed with this approach. And I think this could simply be a case of when looking years into the rearview mirror, there was discussion about a trademark clearinghouse and the notion of information coming from them to URS providers. Then maybe it wasn't fully thought through, how the information that's captured by the trademark clearinghouse is parlayed over to other people that would be looking at that. So I think that's certainly something we want to flag for the working group to consider as a possible recommendation for improvement.
Brian, John Macklin, one last part is I'm not sure that I've also fully understood what the complaint or suspicion or issue truly is about not being able to review the SMD file. So we probably need explanation of that, and then talking to the Trademark Clearinghouse to figure out how those two pieces fit together. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, John. And this is Brian again. I don't know if Zach or Renee or anyone else on the call has seen one of these SMD files, but I think broadly speaking, the question is sufficient information captured in there? So, for example, the trademark registration number at the USPTO, the goods and services that have been listed, the class, for example. But certainly if other people have more experience with that, then we'd be happy to hear from you. So this was, just to take us back, this was, if I remember, from the practitioner survey. And we had on our screen the two charts there. I believe, Barry, correct me if I'm wrong, those were the ones on pages 21 and 22. Did we cover the ones on pages 28 and 29?
Nope, but I can take you through those. The next kind of subtopic was the filing period. That was also part of the practitioner survey. And this is on page 27. Of the survey. Fortunately, I don't have to scroll that much. And the question here is, do you believe the existing timeframes for submitting filings in a URS proceeding are appropriate? Five, almost half agreed. Another three strongly agreed. And there were another three that disagreed with that. Some of the comments or responses to that question: if the URS is meant to be a faster proceeding, then why allow 14 days for a response? The timeline should be shorter. Time for seeking de novo review should be reduced to a single 30-day period. If a registrant hasn't noticed that its domain and website were suspended within that time, the domain is clearly not of great importance to them. And thirdly, the default and appeal filing windows should be shorter.
Right. Thank you, Barry. This is Brian again. And so with that, I think, we can see that there are people who feel that the timeline is good, people who feel like it should be quicker. If I recall, most of the people who responded to this were practitioners who had filed cases. So it's not too much of a leap to see why they might want a quicker result for their clients. If it's agreeable to this subteam, I think what we can do is we can note that there were some people who thought the timeline was adequate, some who thought it was too long. But I think really the core question for us is, again, if we recall that the URS was meant to be a quicker, cheaper complement to the UDRP, notwithstanding some practitioners' desires for quicker timeframes, certainly I think the question that we ourselves need to be asking is it realistic to advance those time frames and still maintain a good notion of due process and give people the opportunity to defend a U.S. claim that's been lodged against them. Of course, if the initial time frame is quicker, then we can look at the various appeals options. But I think it's important that we bear in mind that the time frames do have not only an implication on the filing party, but also on the receiving party. And I see Griffin's put a comment in the chat about not necessarily the time frames themselves, so that's the 14 days to file a response, but the issue about the possible overlapping or duplicative mechanisms for appealing. And certainly that's a question that's been raised during the development of the URS in the first place and is being again raised now. So maybe what we want to do is to look at when we look, for example, there were questions raised earlier about the time frame during which an appeal was filed. And if memory serves, most of those were filed well within the six-month window. So maybe a question for us is, with that knowledge in mind that the six-month window seems to be more than adequate, and I believe there was even a possibility to extend that. And to be honest, I didn't follow exactly the different types of appeals that were possible. There was an appeal from default and then a de novo review, and I think a different type of an appeal that was possible. Maybe Renee or Zach or someone who's more familiar could help me or us better understand the different types of appeals and how they all fit together. But maybe a question for us is, would it be more efficient for everyone involved if those different types of appeals possibilities and timeframes were sort of brought together in a more singular way? Does anyone have any thoughts on what to do there in terms of a recommendation for whether it's the time frame for an initial response or the different appeals types of possibilities?
I'll just note that there is a section below, I believe it's section G or something like that, that is dedicated to appeals.
Good to know, Barry, and maybe that's a good signal that we can come to that when we get to that section. So maybe we can go back to the fourth column. So we were on the practitioner survey, and that moves us now to the filing period, U.S. practitioner survey summary results, page 27. 8 of the 14 responses agree that the timelines are appropriate. I think that largely covers the ground that we've just been covering here. So it seems that those survey results are similar to what we've seen from the previous results on pages 28 and 29. Then we have a question about the word limitation from the practitioner survey on page 26. And if I recall, there were questions about whether the word limits were adequate. So if you recall, there were 500 words for a complaint and I believe 2,500 for a response. And so I think there were some concerns raised by both complainants and respondents whether those were adequate. And again, so while we can certainly flag those for consideration within the broader working group, just wanted to remind people that when we're looking at the URS in a bigger picture sense, of course, one of the things that I think is important we bear in mind is while we can talk about things such as should the time limit be more or less, should the word limit be more or less, should the type of evidence that can be included be more or less, in a bigger picture sense, the URS was meant to be a lighter complement to the EBRP. So if we're moving from a 2,500-word response limitation to at least at WIPO, you have a 5,000-word response limit, just to be mindful of, edging closer to the limitations prescribed in the EBRP and being mindful of whether we're making recommendations that take the URS from its core of a lighter weight complement to the EBRP or whether we're getting more into EBRP territory, and I think that really raises a much more meta question, which I think was behind some of the discussions around whether to move all or part of the URS discussion to the same phase as the EBRP, which is as they edge closer in terms of word limits, timelines, et cetera, what's the relative benefit of having two mechanisms versus one mechanism that might have different, attributes to it. So just for us to kind of bear in mind that bigger picture question when we're making recommendations on timelines, word limits, et cetera. But I think if everyone agrees, we can make a note that in terms of the word limitation, broadly speaking, there seemed to be a perceived need for the ability to issue more words, whether it's in a complaint or in a response. So I think that takes us through A on the complaint and moves us into B, which is the notice. So again, just to recap, we had identified a couple of different sources that I think we handily concluded some time ago. So if we look into the first sub-bullet, which was from the providers, information about what their process is on sending notice, that takes us, and then they had, there was a question about what types of safety valves they had in place regarding non-deliverable messages, and that moves us into the provider responses, which was, Barry, if you're able to flick us over to pages 1 to 3, rows 1 to 8, the provider response notes in terms of the notice.
Okay, so here there are several rows to consider, essentially rows 1 through, well, it's really 4 through 8 is what it should be. They're not as targeted. But essentially the proposed question to the providers is provide information regarding the means by which you communicate with complainants and respondents, including relevant provisions of your supplemental rules. So row 4 is essentially a high-level review of their process. In some cases, they mention how they deal with privacy proxy. There's quite a bit to unpack here, but essentially – that gets into their overall process. Row 5, that question is explain, which I believe is to ADN-DRC supplemental rule, why they rely solely on email for the issuance of notice to the complaint. This has been debated or discussed, I should say, within the provider's subteam. So I suspect that will rise or will be carried over up into the full working group. Row 6 gets into what percentage of any of the communications were to the complainants and registrants were done in ways other than electronically. Again, just more detailed process responses from the providers in terms of physical mail or snail mail. And then secondarily, row 7, which of the two cited methods in the URS Rule 2A do you use to deliver the notice of complaint, including both hard and electronic copy? What mechanisms do you have in place in either method to track actual delivery to a receipt by the respondent? Again, some pretty methodical responses here. And then lastly, row 8 is, do you conform to the communications timeline in accordance with URS Rule 2G, all of which the providers had responded to as yes. So I think really what's before this subteam here, without having to read through all of these responses, is for the members to maybe as a homework assignment read through these in detail, identify if there are any issues different than what the provider's subteam had come up with about one provider not providing or only delivering notice via email. If there's any other issue that boils up, then we can document that from here.
Yeah, thank you, Barry. And this is Brian again. And I think what you said is exactly right. We can take away a little bit of homework to look at these, but these have been pretty thoroughly discussed within the context of that sub-team reviewing those responses, and certainly there was some good discussion around whether all of the requirements on the providers were being met. And so I think we probably don't need to spend too much time in this sub-team going over probably a lot of the same ground that sub-team would go over, but certainly no harm in us just kind of giving it a different pair of eyes. And so maybe we can take that as a note. This falls into that bucket of coordinating the work that's being done across the different sub-teams, and we'll make sure that we fully incorporate the conversations that have been had in that sub-team with respect to these potential notification issues. So I think that moves us on to the next set of questions in this same area, which is the communications with the registry operators, between the providers and the registry operators, which I believe is in that same chart we were just on, which just picking up exactly where we left off on row 8 and moving us into row 9.
Before that, there's also from the practitioners qualitative experiences about what they've seen regarding issues and notice of complaint. And then we'll come back to with the registries. And you'll get from the change log, I did move this up. It was down a couple of sections. There wasn't really even the communications between the providers and the registries really isn't part of the complaint. The notice topic. We didn't actually have a separate section about communications between providers and registries, so it seemed like that was the easiest to put there. So I'll just real quickly from the practitioner surveys results on pages 5 and 6. There were relating to procedural issues. The first question was, when involved as a complainant or its representative in a URS proceeding, were there any difficulties in delivering notice of the proceeding to the respondent? Again, noting that most of the practitioners that responded to this were assisting the complainant, but virtually all of them said that there was no issue. One did make a response that when the respondent uses privacy protection service, in those instances, Forum has been able to obtain the respondent's information on their behalf, which is kind of reinforcing that it's working from their perspective. And then the secondary question, when involved as a respondent or its representative in a URS proceeding, did the respondent experience any issues with receiving notice of the proceeding, not including a delay in sending the notice to its representative? And obviously, it's a converse or a counter question, and because most of the respondents assisted complainants, they had responded back as not applicable. So short way or a really longer way of saying that basically there were no issues identified based on the practitioner survey.
That's so good. All right. Go ahead.
I was just then going to move on to the communications with the registry operators.
Perfect.
Okay. All right. So according to the sub-team, again, qualitative experiences when communicating with registry, getting the domain locked within 24 hours. Again, from the provider's questions, relating to communications with registry operators. So as Brian mentioned earlier, rows 9 and 10. Do you receive notifications from registry operators via email regarding the completion of the URS actions on a domain name? All three providers had responded yes, but there are some nuances here about the delay or sometimes receiving confirmation on the suspension of a domain name, but it's not consistent. Question 10, is do you receive notification via email from registry operators, A, if the URS or if the domain is locked or the URS suspended domain name has been either deleted or purged, if the registration of the URS locked or URS suspended domain name has expired, and thirdly, whether the URS suspended domain name has been renewed for additional year. ADN DRC had said yes in all cases. The primary vendor forum, they located 637 instances of registry correspondence in their URS cases, and they'll be taking a closer look. MFSD had responded no to all three. And then finally, the next question on 11, do you receive information from ICANN with regards to the point of contact from the back-end registry operator appointed by the registry operator? Predominantly from forum is yes, that there are multiple contact names with the registry operator and the back-end, as well as the Ebro contact. And then lastly, which is specifically the question from the document subteam that was asked of the providers, you know, have you experienced any difficulties? ADN DRC said no. Forum does encounter some difficulty and delay in getting responses to verification and lock requests. Registry is likely because there are so few URS cases in comparison to the UDRP. And then lastly, MFSD had said communications are smooth and cordial, but they did have a few issues. So that should take us through both of these right here.
Right. Thanks, Barry. And this is Brian again. So I think we can note that from the practitioner side, there didn't seem to be any issues raised in terms of the notification. Unfortunately, we don't have a huge data set to go off of, but we have what we have, so we can note that. And I note that the forum was going to double check its data in terms of the 600 some odd cases where it had communications with the registries. And then a couple of the responses say, and I see Renee's written in the chat that they did supplement with more information on that in Panama. So maybe we can dig that out and see what the takeaways were. But I do note that there was a comment in the chart that there were some instances of difficulties communicating with registries at different phases, and I can certainly say from our perspective as a UDRP provider that's nothing unexpected. You know, for the most part, the communications seem to work well. You have some anomalies where maybe the registry or registrar isn't aware of what they're supposed to do, or they're just a bit delayed. And for whatever it's worth, in those cases, usually a little bit of a friendly reminder goes a long way. And in some, in a minority of cases, that sometimes needs to be escalated to ICANN for its attention. So maybe we can just take it as a to-do to look at the information that was supplemented in Panama. We can note that there, largely it seems to be working okay with communicating with register operators. There are a few instances where there's a bit of a delay, and then we can see if those delays are something where they're just sort of par for the course, or whether there's a broader issue where there may be some utility in making a recommendation. Probably that involves coordinating with ICANN, because this really, at the end of the day, the registry operators and the registrars in their respective cases are meant to communicate with providers, and if they're not doing that, that seems to be something of a compliance issue. So I think that takes us through to the response, if I'm not mistaken.
For the record, Brian, the last bullet, which was the qualitative experiences from registry operators and receiving the notices from the providers, and so I think there this probably can go back to the larger whoop, or perhaps the decision be made here about how we go about getting those responses, noting that Brian had sent an email out to the list asking about some data of the, you know, the top TLDs, new GTLDs that had received a URS complaint, and perhaps hitting like the top five to see if they had any specific responses.
Yeah, thanks, Barry. And this is Brian again. So maybe what we can do is we can agree on a way that we think we can get something of a critical mass of register operators who have been involved in these cases, and see if we can't put a simple question to them to see if we can't get a little bit better information in terms of why there may be some anomalies in terms of communications between register operators and URS providers. So I think that moves us into Section C, which is the response. I note just to recall that we did, there was some discussion earlier about whether the response period is too long coming from the practitioner survey. And I think in terms of identifying the data sources, certainly we've covered that off. And that moves us into there was a question about reviewing the 250 cases where a response occurred, and I note that in the third sub-bullet there that the staff compilation report had did have some information which I've tried to capture in my comment. I don't know if it's possible to see that up on screen, but we did have some information in terms of the response period and over those 250 cases. And I see Barry's pulling it up on the screen.
All right, so yes, this table, the raw data came from Professor Tushnet's coding exercise, and her team, you know, having gone through each of them, would code whether once occurred within 14 days, within 6 months, or the third, which is really the fourth column, which is not applicable, meaning that they couldn't determine that a response was made. So out of the 827 cases, there were 191 in which a response was received within 14 days. So that's basically about 20% of the cases that, you know, saw a response was filed. 23% of that 827 were filed within that 14-day period. There were an additional 30 of that 827 where the response was filed within 6 months, which, as I understand, refers to the de novo review. And then thirdly, you know, the not applicable 606 of those 827 cases, there was no response filed at all. And essentially, as you work through the table, there it's sorted by those cases where the claim was denied, which allowed further insight when we review some of those cases in general. You know, of the suspended cases, you know, those that had a final determination, 166 of that 167 wound up where it was a final determination, one of which was the default final. And then two, where a split decision occurred, and obviously there were no withdrawals in terms of response with, or if there was any response at all. And then, of course, the those cases where there was a response within 6 months, 24 of those still remained in terms of a default or final or final determination, and a six of that 30, the claim was denied. thus, again, kind of a breakout of the responses. So the idea there was just to try to at least boil down into three or four bulleted percent takeaways. In general, almost a quarter of the cases filed up to the end of 2017 did have some sort of response from the respondent.
Thank you, Barry. And this is Brian again. And just so I make sure I understand the best way to read this data, of those, the 23% of the cases and the 27% of the cases, that's not 23% of those 27%, but that's 23% overall and 27% overall. So that leaves us with 4% of the cases where there was a response that were, the response was filed between the 14 and the days and the 6 months. Is that the right way to read that?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Okay, good. Thanks. And I just wanted to recall that Griffin, who I think has dropped off the call, raised a question earlier about the different types of response periods. So I don't know if it's useful or if it's even possible, Barry, if you might remember from Rebecca's data or otherwise, to see of those 4% of cases, do we have any idea whether those were filed, for example, on day 15 or on day 178? Is there any way to know that?
No. We'd have to go, because there's only 30, we can go look at those and find out. It was just only coded within the six-month window. Yes or no?
Okay. Well, that's useful, and this is Brian again. And I think, if people feel strongly that we ought to dig into that and go into those 30 cases and see exactly when they were filed, certainly we can do that. It may be interesting, but maybe we want to ask ourselves a question with that small number of 4%, whether that's something that we really need to do presently, or that's something that we just sort of note that there were a few cases that did invoke that time window between 14 days and 6 months and leave it there. Do people have any feelings one way or the other on whether we want to dig deeper into that data or just note that some cases were using that longer time period? Okay, and I see David has said he is agreeable with the latter, which is just noting it for now and keeping us moving. So that moves us to the next bullet, which was the URS document subteam to review the cases where 15 or more domains are contained to determine any issue as it relates to the response fee. And so you'll see there were the cases listed there where there were over 15 domain names, so there would have been a response fee due if there was a response. But those cases all were default cases, so unfortunately, it doesn't look like there's a lot to learn in terms of what the number of domain names and the response fee and how those work together, given that those cases weren't defended. I'm not sure that there's much we can glean from that, but certainly if people have views on any takeaways from that, it would be interesting to note those. Does anyone have any thoughts on whether it's possible to draw any conclusions from those cases? I think there were six or seven cases where there were more than 15 domain names, so there would have been a response fee due, but there was no response, so that wasn't in play. Yeah, I see. I would tend to agree. I'm just going to read David McCauley wrote a comment in the chat that it seems unlikely to be a basis for any sound conclusion, and I think that sounds right, so I think we can move on from this question. So that moves us to the next bullet, which was from the providers. There were the qualitative experiences when communicating to the registries, and I think this actually we covered earlier, so this may have been moved from a different section, and there was the sub-bullet about the registry operator responses. So then we have the bullet from the registries, the qualitative experiences about receiving notices from providers. And again, this we covered just earlier where we said we would we would look to identify some of the top registries that were involved in URS cases and try to reach out with them to see if they can help shed any light on the experiences they have communicating with URS providers and see if we can't learn anything from that. So I think that moves us on to D, which is the standard of proof. And again, with all of the work here, I think we've identified the data sources, and we have from this, again, is the standard of proof, we have from the practitioners, the qualitative experiences from the survey on how they thought that standard of proof was applied. And Barry, I don't know if it's possible to flick us over to the results of that practitioner survey. I don't recall off the top of my head what those particular experiences that the practitioners shared with us were, so it would be useful for us to jog our collective memory perhaps on what they were telling us.
So this is page 14 of their survey. They asked, do you believe that the URS is primarily being used for the types of cases for which it was intended, namely clear cases of abuse? Basically, 11 of the 14 had voted and agreed or strongly agreed, while two neither agreed nor disagreed, and there were no negative responses from that. Secondarily, there was guidance on clear and convincing evidence, which is on page 17. The question asked here is, should there be more guidance provided to educate or instruct practitioners on what is needed to meet the clear and convincing burden of proof in a URS proceeding? The results were split here. Practically just about half that, yes, some guidance could be provided or no guidance should be provided, three of which had no opinion. And secondarily, the current standard of proof is appropriate. So page 18, the next survey question was then asked, based on your experience as a URS practitioner, is the standard of clear and convincing evidence for the burden of proof in a URS proceeding appropriate? And four had responded that it's too high. Seven had stated that it was appropriate, and two with no opinion at all. And then finally, should the standard be modified, which is pages 19 and 20, so their first question here was, based on your experience with URS, should the standard of burden of proof be modified? A few have said that it should be lowered. A majority had said that no, it was adequate. One with no opinion. And then, it was basically follow-up responses. Basically, every effort should be made to reduce costs of dealing with cyber squatting, which is a harm to the public as well as the trademark owner. And then regarding remedies, I'd like to see an option of voluntary negotiated transfer from a losing respondent to a prevailing complainant, which kind of gets more into the remedies and not so much the standard of proof. I'll stop there.
Yeah, thanks, Barry. That's very helpful, and I completely agree with that last point, which is that's possibly for a different section. I don't know how people feel about this. It looks like there are basically split views on whether the standard of proof is appropriate or not. So candidly, I don't know where that leaves us in terms of making a potential recommendation for whether for the working group or for the community. Some people think it's just right. Some people think it's too high. On that, I would just recall for us again, when we're looking at kind of the bigger picture and what was the URS intended to do, this was meant to be a complement to the UDRP for clear, obvious cases. So I would just flag for us if we did start to get into a conversation about whether the burden of proof is too high ought to be amended, to certainly bear in mind that this was sort of meant to be in the DNA of the URS, which was that it was a lighter mechanism and that merited a higher burden of proof. And I see David and Phil in the queue. So please, David, go ahead.
Thanks, Brian. David McCauley speaking for the record. I'll be very quick. With respect to the standard of proof, I think that's our job, not the practitioners. I think maybe we should note this to the full group that we have comments like this, but it strikes me that that's our job to come up with the standard. With respect to instructions on what clear and convincing means, given that this is a practice that's done all over the world, and there may be some countries where that's not a term that people are familiar with, maybe some rudimentary instruction of what clear and convincing means would be appropriate. But I see that Phil's next, and I look forward to his comments. Thanks.
Thanks, David. Phil?
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Phil, for the record, and having been involved, with all the STIRT and all the efforts to develop this, it was meant to be distinct from UDRP, a supplement only for black and white cases. So when you think about well-known, standards of proof, at least in Western jurisprudence, there's preponderance of the evidence, which is like 51% plus, that's UDRP. There's beyond a reasonable doubt, that's for criminal cases. And then there's preponderance, which is, somewhere in between. There's no defined percentage, but it's a higher standard. But if we were going to change it and lower it, it's not clear how we could still distinguish it from the UDRP in that aspect. And the last observation is that despite it being a higher burden than UDRP, the folks who have brought cases have won them in the vast majority of cases. So for black and white cases, it's no impediment to suspending the domain. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. And I think those are both David and Phil excellent points. And possibly, there's been the notion of some guidance for examiners. Maybe this is one of the things where, again, as Phil said, it may be hard to draw a bright line, but certainly something more than a 51%, something less than 100%. But that may be useful. So certainly I think we should record that here, and that possibly could form part of the examination guideline or checklist. So I think that moves us into the bullet, which is the URS document subteam to review the 58 cases where a respondent prevailed. And if we move on to the next bullet below that, we have the work in progress, which is the staff compilation report, which is on the URS data pages 17 to 21, Table 12, the analysis of cases where the URS claim was denied. Barry, is it possible to move us over to that to have a quick look? I'm not personally familiar, although maybe when I see it on screen it will jog my memory a little bit.
Thank you, Brian. So I guess what will help is first kind of going back to the response analysis table. It is, in fact, actually 59 cases and not 58, as our table demonstrates. What was good about the response analysis is that it immediately allowed us to divide and conquer these 59, because the original ask is to understand, the evidence and the bad faith use of a domain name. So, of the 59, 31 of the cases didn't have a response, or meaning that they, that the respondent wasn't citing a particular defense. That of those 59, 31 of the cases were denied on the evidence submitted or the merits by which the complainant submitted the case. So then you can look at it from the converse lens, where 28 cases of those 59, there was a response and the respondent won on a particular cited defense. So this particular analysis is work in progress. And I think it would probably behoove either this sub-team or the full working group to take a little bit closer look at this. We only have 5 minutes, so I'm just going to try to explain it high level. We went through this, I think, before the Panama meeting, and a majority of the data here is based upon Professor Tushnet's coding exercise. So what I wound up doing is, and I think what I'll do real quick is try to show you in her actual analysis, they get into the section over here of the case analysis, and specifically column Alpha Gulf, you know, they asked if a response was filed, what defenses or facts were submitted to refute the bad faith allegation. And basically what you'll see here is they have a number of codes that they had defined when they were coding this. For instance, code number one is registrant's use of domain is for a bona fide offering of good and services. Code number four is the domain is generic descriptive and registrant is making fair use. Code number nine is other. Code number three is registrant is making fair use of domain without profiting or misleading consumers, et cetera. So there's basically 10 different types of codes that they had filled in when reviewing each case. This first table here on page 17 is a pivot table of those codes. So kind of moving to the bottom, and let me zoom in a little bit more so that you can read this on the Adobe Connect room. Down at the bottom, there's this entry for not applicable. So that's the 31 cases of the 59 where the claim was denied, where there was no response. So now we have these other 28 possibilities of the defense that was coded in the review of these cases. And so again, you can see all the different coding options that Rebecca's team had put in here. So for example, there were four that only had the code of other. The code number eight, the examiner did not provide detail. Two cases wound up with that. There were two cases where code four, the domain is generic and descriptive and registrant is making fair use and other were used and so on and so forth. So the question is, you know, first are these codes enough to make any conclusions from as it relates to the defenses from the respondent? Or should this group actually go take a closer look at these 28 cases and understand if there are any additional defenses being used that are not included in sections 5.7 and 5.8 of the procedures. So secondarily, this is a pivot table of the 31 cases where there was no response, and this is basically from column Alpha Kilo of Rebecca's spreadsheet, and they did the same exact kind of coding exercise, but why the complainant failed to provide the adequate evidence. And so they have a code there, registered domain name is identical, confusingly similar, registrant has no legitimate right or interest to the domain name, and you got to think about it in the converse, is why did the complainant fail here? And it's because the examiner did find that the registrant did have a legitimate right and interest to the domain name. And then finally, the conclusion. And again, this is this third table is just a slimmed down version of looking at the defenses. So I'll stop there. We're basically out of time. But I think we should, you know, at our next meeting, probably spend more time about whether more work is needed here. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Barry. That's good. And this is Brian again for the record. And so I maybe just a couple of things in conclusion. I think it could, like you say, be useful to look, do a little bit of a deeper dive into those 31 cases. Is anyone able to do that in advance of next week's call? I can certainly have a glance myself, but it would be very helpful if anyone were able to raise their hand for that. And just while we're waiting for a reaction from anyone, I just wanted to note in the final bullet in this section was about the idea of an examiner's guide, and I think we've covered that sufficiently. But just to note that when I looked at the history of the IRT report, they actually did have in an appendix exactly this type of a guide that they were foreseeing as a kind of a template for the decision. So that might be useful for us to a note for the broader working group. And I see there's a comment from Mary in the chat that the staff can help clean up the table and provide some bullet points or additional points for the sub-team's consideration before next week, if that helps. I personally would find that very helpful. I'm sure others agree that the work here has been tremendous. And then Barry has said he will provide the case numbers. This is, I'm assuming, with respect to these 31 cases. And again, if anyone, we can take this onto the email list, just in the interest of time. But if anyone is able to assist in having a look at those, I see Zach says that he may be able to chip in. That would be very useful. Certainly, more pairs of eyes on this is better. And David says if we can divide up, maybe David, that's a good point. Maybe if once we have the list, we could sort of partition that out. I know we have maybe 10 or a dozen people in the working group. This might be a good place to invoke the many hands make light work notion, and so maybe we could each take 5 or 6 of those and to help spread the workload. So I think that we can consider this a good call. We've left off with E, the defenses, and I see there's a note there which sort of moves us into remedies F. We've discussed that to some extent. I know David had some comments he wanted to make. He mentioned in the chat earlier. So if it's agreeable to everyone, we can divide up looking at those 30-odd cases. We can continue our discussions on our list. I will coordinate with staff and the co-chairs to see, what we do in terms of taking these recommendations into the broader working group and coordinating the work with the other sub-teams and what we think is the best way to take that forward. And with that, we can pick up with F remedies the next time we get together. Thanks again, everyone. It's been a really productive call, and appreciate all of the work, especially from staff on this. So thanks again. And with that, I think we can end the call. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you. Today's meeting has been adjourned. Thank you all for joining, and you can disconnect online. Thank you.